there's so much that goes into being a nurse that a lot of people don't realize.
A nurse is someone that cares, regardless of their skin color or their gender.
Nurses are kind. There's a kindness, I think, that lies under everything that nurses do.
Being able to touch patients during their most vulnerable times is why I do it every day.
Nursing at its core is developing a sense of community.
I don't think you have to wear scrubs to be a nurse. I think a nurse is anyone who's willing to take on the mantle of caring for someone else, because it's not always easy.
Like, nursing is a great profession for all, whether you're male, female. It's you know, there's lots of opportunities. There's lots of different pathways.
Nursing is a profession that is really important, that it reflects the community it serves.
I'm a nurse.
I'm a nurse.
I am a nurse.
It's your time to become a nurse. Visit nursing.jhu.edu/onthepulse.
Hi, I'm Tamara Rodney, and you're listening to On the Pulse, a podcast from the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. On this podcast, we take a deep dive into the experiences of frontline providers and researchers. We explore their insights and invaluable stories of how healthcare works in today's world. Obesity is considered an epidemic across the world. According to the World Health Organization, obesity has nearly tripled since 1975, and 39 million children under the age of 5 were overweight or obese in 2020. Just recently, the American Academy of Pediatrics released a new set of guidelines for evaluating and treating children and adolescents with obesity. Our guests today are going to help us unpack the Academy's recommendations and what all of us need to know about curbing the obesity epidemic around the world. Dr. Eliana Perring is a Bloomberg Distinguished Professor in Pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and School of Nursing. She's a general pediatrician with research expertise in obesity prevention and treatment, particularly in primary care settings. Her work focuses on health disparities among minoritized populations, and her interventions are culturally responsive and literacy sensitive. In all she does, she aims to help children grow up healthy. And Dr. Nakia Shawal is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, a general pediatrician, associate program director of pediatrics residency program, and medical director of the Harriet Lane Clinic. Her clinical, educational, and research career focuses on addressing pediatric, socioeconomic, and racial ethnic health disparities among marginalized and minoritized populations, with a particular focus on obesity and cardiovascular disease risk. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us. It's an honor.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Dr. Perring, if I could start with you. You've studied obesity for many years. What would you say we know about obesity, and what has caused this epidemic, particularly among children?
Well, for as much as we know about obesity, there's still an awful lot we don't know. We know that obesity is a chronic disease with multifactorial causes. Obesity is very complex. We know that there's a genetic component to it, and some families have the deck of cards, so to speak, stacked against them. We also know that racism, poverty, and what many call a toxic food environment are root causes. And we think that behaviors matter too, though we know that behaviors aren't always about choice. And this is where the inequities come into play and why we see disparities in the rates of obesity. Some families simply don't have the same choices over their behaviors as others because of being, say, in neighborhoods that have had systematic disinvestment, for example, don't have lots of safe green space to play, or because parents have to work two jobs to make ends meet. So the corner store advertising that hot dog, chips, and soda is the more realistic option than home cooking a baked chicken and vegetables. And unfortunately, fast food companies target Black and brown neighborhoods, so this all becomes a vicious cycle. Another thing to say, though, is that while we know that there are some risk factors for obesity, we also know that some children are resilient to these risk factors, and other children don't have risk factors and still end up with overweight obesity. So all in all, it's a complex chronic condition that has many causes and a lot left to learn.
We certainly do have a lot to learn, and it seems it's very complex. Dr. Shawal, can I ask, do you have any additional thoughts on what has caused this epidemic, particularly among children?
Absolutely. As Dr. Perrin alluded to, it's important to note that the underlying drivers of the condition confer different risk of obesity for different individuals and families, resulting in the disparities that we observe. And often there's interplay between these risk factors. So for example, those who face structural racism are more likely to experience inequalities in economic conditions that have been linked to increased risk of obesity. Therefore, when we think about how we address and tackle such a complex condition like obesity, it truly necessitates an enhanced understanding of which risk factors or which underlying inequalities are at play for each individual child and family. And we as clinicians, as pediatric healthcare professionals, partnering with children and their families must truly understand and acknowledge the role of both individual behaviors, but equally important, understanding the family's influences and the broader contextual risk factors that are in play in order to take a more tailored and effective approach to obesity treatment for children and adolescents.
Thank you. Saying it's complex is an understatement, but you've both been delivering healthcare initiatives for children for a long time. And as clinicians, can I ask, why is it important for it to be addressed in childhood, but more specifically, at what age would parents need to start thinking about this? And if I could start with you, Dr. Shaw.
Sure. So as we think about the known intergenerational effects of obesity, there are certainly many opportune moments to highlight prevention of childhood obesity. For example, there's strong evidence linking maternal obesity with increased birth weight and increased risk of obesity during early childhood, including infancy. Additionally, there's growing evidence that even preconception parental obesity can play a role in the development of obesity in a future children. Therefore, truly, it's never too early to intervene and to have conversations around obesity prevention and management with adults and their children. And these conversations can start with adults even before they become parents. And during these conversations, we really should be stressing the importance of how health behaviors and the health status of parents can not only impact their own health, but also impact their future child's health as well.
Thank you. So we're looking at it across a lifespan, really.
Absolutely.
So it's never too early to start. And Dr. Perrin, from your standpoint, why do you think it's important that clinicians continue to address this in childhood?
So we know that there's a lot of studies that show that most children with obesity become adolescents with obesity, and most adolescents with obesity become adults with obesity. In other words, that obesity really does track across the lifespan, not for every child, but for many, many children. And we know that obesity treatment is hard. And we know that behaviors adopted early on are likely to persist and hard to change. And so from all of those standpoints, we should really be addressing the prevention of obesity as early as possible by fostering those healthy behaviors right from the get-go. We do this to try to prevent obesity for sure, but we also do this because the things that we're recommending, like being physically active, not watching television or being on screens, not drinking sugary beverages, all of these behaviors actually have benefits beyond just the benefits of obesity prevention. They have benefits for mental health, preventing cavities, getting calories that are more nutrient rich than just sugar. And so for all of these reasons, we feel like adopting these behaviors early on will serve double duty and help children from becoming overweight, but also do so many other things to confer health benefits across the lifespan.
Just listening to you talk, I guess sometimes we think of bringing a child to the doctor, to the pediatrician when something is wrong. But what you're saying is a lot of it has to be prevention. What role do you think does a clinician play in educating parents, especially about the risks of obesity in childhood?
So the pediatric healthcare provider has a very, very important role. As pediatricians or pediatric healthcare providers, prevention is at our core. So whether it is obesity or other chronic conditions, we have an eye to prevention. We have conversations about prevention in all of our visits with children. And as pediatricians, we see children very regularly and often during those first 2 years of life. So there's lots of opportunities to have these conversations around healthy behavior change, around understanding what the family and broader environment looks like for that family, and how those can present opportunities or challenges to health behavior promotion. And so obesity is no different. It is a chronic condition. And then we as pediatricians certainly have the opportunity and the windows of opportunity to have conversations with families, to really partner with families around prevention, but also once it's identified to really talk about effective management options.
You know, parents really have lots of questions about feeding early on, about activity early on. They want their children to grow up healthy, and they do see their pediatrician or pediatric clinician, be it a nurse practitioner or family physician or pediatrician, they see that person as a trusted advisor for all things related to helping their children grow up healthy. And our discipline, the discipline of pediatrics, was founded on measuring growth. And so they have questions about whether their children are growing okay. And so these questions, these conversations come up naturally for us. And we are doing the families we serve a service by addressing these questions in ways that make sense for them and in ways that really partner with them towards helping their children grow up healthy.
Much of how you practice are guided by guidelines. And these guidelines I'm referring to are some of the more recent one released from the American Academy of Pediatrics. In your summary, what would you say the overall recommendations are? And is there anything in those guidelines that might spark some controversy?
Thank you for that question. So this is the American Academy of Pediatrics, or AAP's, first clinical practice guideline outlining and summarizing the evidence for evaluation and treatment of children and adolescents with overweight and obesity. And really, the overall goal of the guideline is to relay information to pediatricians and other pediatric healthcare providers, nurse practitioners, et cetera, about the current evidence-based approaches to evaluation and also treatment of children who are identified as having overweight or obesity. It's also a guideline to address, to provide information on how to evaluate and treat obesity-related comorbidities like hypertension, diabetes, dyslipidemia. Importantly, the guideline does not include guidance for evaluation and treatment of overweight and obesity amongst children less than 2 years of age, and also does not discuss primary obesity prevention, which is a topic that's going to be addressed in a future AAP policy statement. So those are two things to take note of. And just to provide a brief summary of some of the recommendations, one, the guideline highlights the importance of identification. So proper identification of overweight and obesity amongst children and adolescents, as well as obesity-related conditions. And as we've already alluded to, identification is critical, and because children and adolescents with obesity have a higher rate of persistent obesity as adults, and they have a higher rate of having those obesity-related comorbidities that I mentioned already. The importance of seeing obesity as a chronic condition is another element that the guideline emphasizes. Obesity is a chronic disease. Obesity is a chronic disease and should be treated as such through utilization of the medical home with intensive and long-term care treatment options. And in identifying overweight and obesity, the guideline also highlights the importance of understanding the child's and family's social context, as we've mentioned, the risk factors that are uniquely present and the role these risk factors play in the promotion or perpetuation of this condition. And the guideline also provides specific treatment approaches once obesity is identified. Treatment should be delivered using a family-centered, empathetic, supportive manner and a non-stigmatizing approach that goes beyond the traditional dietary and physical activity assessment realm and considers all of these other factors that are in play and that portend certain risks to certain families. And again, treatment should always be approached with consideration of what opportunities and potential challenges that child and family may face according to their social and broader context. Treatment options include, one, intensive health behavior and lifestyle treatment, or IHBLT, which is the most effective known behavioral treatment of child obesity, not widely available and can be challenging to deliver, which we'll talk about shortly, but it is the most effective known behavioral treatment that is available. Two, as an adjunct to this behavioral lifestyle treatment, pediatricians should also offer adolescents age 12 years and older options for obesity weight loss pharmacotherapy based on the risk and benefit profile of those medications, as well as the indications for those particular medications. And pediatricians, as well as other pediatric healthcare providers, should also offer referrals for adolescents age 13 and older with severe obesity for evaluation of potential metabolic and bariatric surgery. So these are some of just the recommendations summarized from the guideline. And again, the first clinical practice guideline that the AEP has developed and disseminated around this very important topic.
I can take on the controversies. You know, the CPG has so many important pieces to it that Dr. Scholl just discussed, but there certainly has been controversy about the guidelines. Certainly, the guidelines do a really great job of discussing some of the root causes that we talked about earlier, and as well as the role of stigma in obesity perpetuation. But fundamentally, they do start from the place that obesity and poor health are related. And that's not necessarily true for every child. And a lot of people don't necessarily believe that's a stance that is appropriate. I think the other controversial thing is that treatments that are recommended are not always accessible or affordable. Many of the medications are not covered currently by insurance. And while the hope is that the guidelines will prompt payment reform, since they are evidence-based treatments, for now, that puts people in a bit of a pickle. And so I think that part of it has been challenging. Similarly, Dr. Scholl and I are fortunate to practice at Johns Hopkins, where we have easy access to specialists. If the labs that are recommended come back abnormal and we need a consultation, we have obesity treatment options for children and adolescents with obesity, but many providers don't have those good options. And so again, they are left a bit more struggling to figure out the best things to do for families now that there are guidelines suggesting that they should do one thing, but that thing that's being suggested is hard to access. One additional thing I wanted to mention is how the guidelines might be thought of by primary care providers. And on the one hand, guidelines are amazing for primary care providers, right? Because a very hardworking group essentially did the homework for us. They looked through hundreds of scientific papers and did it with incredible rigor and scholarship. These are top, top people in the field who are doing our homework for us and figuring out the best evidence and ways to practice that make most sense based on what we now know. And that's what's really great about guidelines. Unfortunately, what's hard about guidelines is that they give us primary care providers a lot to think about and do in each and every visit when we see a child with obesity. And these days, particularly with the pandemic's increased rates of obesity, is a lot of visits. And providers are already doing so much with very limited time. And so I think the sheer size of the clinical practice guidelines document, it was over 70 pages, scared some of our colleagues at first. But the American Academy of Pediatrics already has resources that make the guidelines easier to adopt. And I know that in time, there will be even more resources to help the busy pediatrician, help these guidelines make sense for the families that they're seeing. And I think Dr. Scholl did such a beautiful job of describing that these are guidelines, that these conversations need to take place on an individual level with families and make sure that what we're recommending makes sense for each of the patients that we're seeing.
Thank you for highlighting that, because you have your finger on the pulse. And so you can apply this to the individuals that you see and making it situation specific. And as you said, they're guidelines. There's no way for it to be completely comprehensive. But you also highlighted that a lot of thoughtful homework has gone into creating these. So Dr. Scholl, my question to you is, why is it really important to consider these new recommendations? And if we don't, what will happen to the epidemic? How will we get it under control?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I will say that despite the controversy that has been sparked by the guidelines, it's really important to reiterate some of the messaging that the guideline includes. And the guideline does a really great job of highlighting child obesity as a chronic condition. And like other chronic conditions, we must employ early and periodic diagnosis and approaches that are comprehensive and that are accessible and available for all, not just for some. And although the guideline offers many treatment options that may seem intense for some, that may seem challenging to implement, they do acknowledge this, and they do acknowledge that there is differential accessibility and availability for children and adolescents, and offer options on how we can move forward from this. And particularly as it pertains to equitable access to treatment options, I really see this as one of the areas where I envision, or I hope the guideline can facilitate impactful change. In addition to being read by pediatric healthcare providers, our hope is that these recommendations will really come to the attention of payers and policymakers who are really in the position to move the needle on promoting accessibility and availability of effective treatments for all children. And to your question, if this is not able to be done, or in other words, if we're not able to effectively address this epidemic head on, we will continue to see rising rates of obesity and obesity-related conditions among children, adolescents, and adults. And the disparities that have been longstanding that we've observed will only widen.
Important warning. So let's follow the guidelines as we can and make improvements as we go. Thank you for highlighting that. So I'm always amazed when I read or clinicians bio about the amount of work you do. And I just wanted to, as researchers, clinician, and educator, Dr. Perrin, I discovered that you're working on a study called Greenlight. Can you tell us a little bit more about what Greenlight is and what have you learned so far from this study?
Sure. How long is your podcast? I could talk about Greenlight all day. It's a really wonderful program. So Greenlight is all about prevention, but the Greenlight program really starts well before these guidelines address. So the Greenlight program is an early childhood obesity program developed by me and many colleagues that helps parents help their children grow up healthy from the start. The program has been at 6 institutions and is now at 7, including Johns Hopkins. And it teaches providers about health communication and offers a series of booklets to parents that address questions about early feeding, activity, screen time, sleep, and many other areas where they have questions. And we hopefully have some helpful input. The booklets take a low health literacy approach and do a lot with graphics and pictures and color coding, and they're meant to be shared between clinical providers and parents. At the end of the booklet is a place for families to set goals, such as to help their children watch less screens or drink less sugar-sweetened beverages. And we have these booklets, the entire program, available in Spanish and Chinese, as well as English. And in terms of what we've learned so much. We had a funded trial that tested the program, and we found that parents who used the Greenlight program starting at 2 months had infants who gained weight more appropriately instead of too fast and were less overweight up until age 18 months. But we also learned that we need to start prevention even earlier than that first trial, because even two-month-olds, which is the age that we began that first trial, were being put in front of the TV to watch TV. They were being put in front of the TV intentionally. And many parents were exclusively bottle feeding and feeding with bottles that were much larger than necessary, which can promote overfeeding. So we're now studying the program, but starting in the newborn period. And we're looking at whether we can add to the booklets with text messaging to parents to try and help them learn at times that are outside of well-child visits. Because even though we have a lot of well-child visits, there's still much more time, obviously, that parents are not in the doctor's office. And we'd love to help them have some practical tips for adopting these healthy behaviors in real time. And because the children enrolled in Greenlight study are mostly Hispanic or non-Hispanic Black, and most of the families are from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, we've also learned a lot about and from families that are rarely included in pediatric research. And so we're really excited about that. And we have included their thoughts and guidance as we've gone about the project. So as you can see, a really fun project with a lot of potential where we as researchers are constantly iterating, trying to make the program better, trying to make it more accessible, trying to really learn from parents and clinicians about what works for them.
That's amazing. It certainly sounds like you're having a great time doing it, and we look forward to see what are the outcomes you get from this. But would it be fair to say that this represents a partnership between clinicians and parents and families?
Absolutely. We have really had advice from families at every step along the way, as well as advice from a lot of people involved in the pediatric encounters, people like interpreters and lactation consultants and clinicians. And we're really trying to learn from this partnership about how to provide better care and how to appropriately answer parents' questions and help them help their children grow up healthy.
From fun to difficult, I'm going to throw this question out for either of you. When it comes to weight management, how do you navigate conversations around weight management? It's a difficult subject. And how do you talk about balancing weight with body image? And we also know that eating disorders are on the rise. So how do these conversations differ by age and how do you tackle them?
Such a great question. And weight is a super sensitive subject. And I like to say food is love in just about every culture. So these topics really reach home in a very important way. But I try to remember a few things, mostly things that I've learned after interviewing lots of parents. First, most parents want to be having these conversations with their pediatric providers. I always ask and I encourage my trainees to ask permission to talk about this subject. In all my years of doing this, I've only had two no's to that asking of permission. And those no's were every bit as important as all the yeses I've gotten. Second, parents want to know about concerning trends in their children's weight early on, and they want to help their children grow up healthy. Third, they definitely want the conversation to mostly be about health, and it should be about health, and it should be stigma-free, as Dr. Showell said. And fourth, they'd like primary care providers, pediatricians, family physicians, nurse practitioners to be the ones to have these conversations with families. These are the people that have the longitudinal relationships with families, the trust, the understanding of the family's cultural preferences, and they can keep things health focused. In fact, that's their job, rather than focused on how bodies look. And providers can ensure that the goal setting should be done with motivational interviewing so that families are coming up with goals that align with what they're able and motivated to do. And we providers should bring families back frequently. So these aren't one-off communications. We're not just sharing with families, oh, your child has overweight and we'll see you in a year. But we are instead communicating that this is important. And we want to partner with you. What's working? What's not working? What are the barriers to what we talked about? What went well? What didn't go well? And most importantly, how can I be helpful moving forward? So we are on this journey with parents. We know behavioral change is hard. We know the subject is hard, but we care intensely about their children's health. And that's why we're having these conversations. And so keeping it health-focused, keeping it focused on behavior change that really has so many benefits beyond just obesity prevention or treatment, I think is the way to go with these difficult conversations.
And if I could add, certainly agree with Dr. Perrin's recommendations, particularly focusing our conversations with children and their families on health and health promotion. And as pediatricians and pediatric healthcare providers, that is, again, at the core of what we do. Whether we are speaking about obesity or other chronic conditions, or speaking about their child's health and well-being in general. And we should continue to use non-stigmatizing or neutral language, and also using first-person language. For example, we would say a child with obesity or a child with overweight, not obese child or overweight child. And we know, though, that even when we're using non-stigmatizing language, that having conversations about weight can still be difficult. And for some families can still trigger strong emotional responses, and that certain sensitivities can be revealed when we are having these conversations. Therefore, it's imperative that we continue to communicate in a way that's supportive, empathetic, open, and we should always continue to hold partnership at the center of what we do and continue to forge alliances with children and families in an ongoing and longitudinal manner.
If I can just jump in, Dr. Showell's discussion about using person-first language, and I'm reminded of a really smart colleague's suggestion about how to remember to do this is we would never say cancer child. So the idea that we say obese child undermines both that person as a person first, as well as the fact that we are dealing with a disease, we are dealing with a condition, and this isn't an adjective for the child.
That's a very powerful way to remind us of that language is important and that the language that we use does matter. And I'm not sure if you can tap this because you've given us so much incredible information to think about. But if I could ask you, if there's one message that you would like to leave with our listeners today, or for clinicians or children or parents alike, what would that be?
I would like to leave the audience, clinicians, children, and parents, with a message of hope. You know, we've talked about a lot of information today, some of which may seem daunting. And multifaceted conditions like obesity necessitate multifaceted and sometimes complex solutions. And we acknowledge that and understand that. And we as pediatricians, a big part of our job is to help children and their families understand this information that's digestible and that's relevant to them. And what I will say is that our approaches to managing child obesity really showcase the importance of partnership amongst clinicians, children, and their families. Obesity is a condition that can be better treated when clinicians partner with children and their families to, one, broaden their understanding of the unique circumstances, their home and neighborhood environments, potential other underlying contributors to obesity risk, and secondly, offer tailored approaches that are family-centered, again, non-stigmatizing, supportive, and comprehensive. Then my message for parents and caregivers, ask all the hard questions, discuss any concerns, you know, have those ongoing conversations when things change, when new challenges arise, when new opportunities arise. And together, you and your child's healthcare provider can achieve the common goal that we both want to achieve, which is keeping your child healthy.
I'll just close with obesity is very complex. And so these very carefully considered and constructed guidelines, which are based on available evidence, are still going to have complexities in implementation and reception. My hope is that these guidelines help center this as an important medical problem and that it gives us the path forward to partner with families in ways that make the best sense for families. Also, the complexity of obesity treatment for me does underscore the supreme importance of prevention, but also of policy. And so I want to add to Dr. Scholl's messages to providers and families, a message to policymakers. Please help our children grow up in environments that are less obesity promoting and with improved equity so that they can grow up to be as healthy as possible.
Thank you both for conveying your dedication as clinicians. This has been a rich discussion around obesity. What is the difficult topic? You've injected hope and emphasizing the importance of partnership with not just the children, but with their families as well. So thank you both. I think it's an issue that we all recognize and one that we can all play a part in helping to solve. So thank you again for being with us today and for sharing your wisdom and expertise.
And thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been a great discussion.
Wonderful. It certainly has. And thank you to everyone for listening to this episode of On the Pulse. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with someone you know and subscribe through Apple, Stitcher, and Spotify. You can also find us on the Health Podcast Network at healthpodcastnetwork.com/nurse. Be sure to also check out our On the Pulse blog. You can learn more about the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing at nursing.jhu.edu. Thanks again for listening.